Hello, welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode on this happy day, Dominic, because it is your birthday. So what are you, 38, 39?
Yeah, exactly, 35. It's the birthday as well, Tom, of Richard III.
Oh, yes.
And I think Gandhi. So very similar people.
Very well.
All human life is there.
Your murderous willingness to destroy all opposition to reach the throne and your love of peace.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously explained by astrological conjunction. That all three of you are born on this day. So many happy returns.
Thank you, Tom. That's kind.
But enough about you. Shall we move on to some questions?
Well, just before we do that, let's just remind people what's coming up, because we will forget otherwise. So, Tom, they're in the middle of fascism.
They're three quarters of the way through. But also they've had them all in
one fell swoop. Oh, yeah, of course, that's true.
So probably everyone will have heard all the fascist stuff.
And if you haven't heard it, they're four great episodes, if I'd say so myself. And what's lovely is we're joined by a special guest in episode three. A real historical expert, the Right Honourable Jeremy Corbyn, joins us in episode three, which is jolly good fun. And Tom, next week, very exciting, we launch a big series about the history, or the very early history, of Baghdad.
The golden age of Baghdad.
Yeah.
Kind of one of those great moments of civilization where a particular city takes on the luster of the capital of the world.
Yeah.
Surrounded by an aura of romance and poetry. And absolutely, as I will be arguing, a seismic influence on the history of the world, not just of Islam. So I hope you'll all enjoy that.
So I've heard the first two of those. Well, when I first say I've heard them, I was in them. And they're brilliant. It was really, really interesting. We're recording the next two on Wednesday, aren't we?
Yeah. So we've got the Golden Age, which is the age of Harun al-Rashid, as in he's the caliph who, more than any other, appears in the Arabian Nights. And the last episode will be the city that changed the world. Looking at all the way that its influence continues to reverberate into the present. So we hope you enjoy those. And then after that, is it Captain Cook?
I think Captain Cook is coming, JFK and the Conquistadors. So lots of fun things. Two other fun things, actually, Tom. On Monday the 9th, so that's a week from today when we're recording this, Monday the 9th of October, we have a quiz for our Athelstan members. So Athelstans, you should get an email about that. And the following week, so Monday the 16th, we will be doing our live stream, a bonus episode. So again, you'll all get a link about that.
And themes for that to be decided.
Yes.
But we are mulling it over.
So Tom, shall we do some questions?
Yes. So here is a question that I know will appeal to you, Dominic.
Yeah.
Liz Sistrata. I only discovered Nancy Mitford's Peerless novels when I learned English, because obviously they were not translated into Polish under communism. I checked recently and Pursuit of Love came out in Polish translation only recently, nearly a century after it was first published. My question is, therefore, are Tom and Dominic fans of Nancy's novels, or do they prefer Decca Mitford's writings? So, Dominic.
Well, I'm not a great fan of the Mitfords. Actually, the only thing I've read of Nancy Mitford's was her thing about the difference between you and non-you. I've never read her novels.
Was that a social history?
It was an article from the 50s in which she listed all the things that you might say that would identify you as common. So fish knives, apparently, I think, were the use of the word serviette rather than napkin.
I mean, the thing is that she did kind of write it as a joke. So I know that people who make jokes and people take them seriously, Dominic, that has never happened to you.
Never.
So it was kind of one of those jokes that obviously she did secretly mean.
Yeah, I think she was having a cake and eating it, wasn't she?
I love Nancy Mitford. I've always loved her books, Pursuit of Love and Love in a Cold Climate, particularly the two classics. And I think that the Mitford myth would be nothing without them at all. I think the obsession with Mitfords is entirely dependent on the kind of the gloss that Nancy gave them in those two novels.
But her continued prominence in British letters in the 1950s meant that the Mitfords were remembered when otherwise they might have been forgotten, don't you think?
Yeah, but it's her ability to mythologize their upbringing, to mythologize their parents as Uncle Matthew and Aunt Sadie, and essentially to give no mention whatsoever to all the fascist shenanigans that were going on in the background, or indeed the communism.
Yeah.
It's all kind of washed away. And I think the measure of that is, so Liz Sistrata is asking about Decca Mitford. So that's Jessica Mitford, who was the Stalinist, who ended up in America, very kind of violently estranged from her family. And she wrote a book called Ons and Rebels, which is an account of the Mitford's childhood and upbringing. But it's an account that would be unthinkable without Nancy Mitford's. So Jessica Mitford's account is not an actual reminiscence. It's a commentary on Nancy Mitford's.
On her own sisters.
Yeah. She also, you must have read American Way of Death.
Do you know, I haven't.
That's great. About the funerals in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I've heard
of that. That's a great book, I think. That's a really good book.
Do you know what, Tom? Theo has written in the chat. There is no way Dominic would rather spend his birthday than still discussing the Bitfords.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. So I like them. Dominic doesn't. Unsurprising.
I said on the podcast, Tom, I've seen their graves many times because there's a lovely walk in the Cotswolds to a place called Swinbrook.
I've never been to the graves. I've never been.
You'd love it, actually. There's a medieval church, which is just sort of, I assume there must have been a village around it, which has disappeared. So the church is in the middle of nowhere. And then you walk back to the church at Swinbrook. From this church was a place called Widford. And there are the graves.
So who's buried there? Unity's there, isn't she?
I think Unity's there. I can't remember how many of them are there. There's a very good pub. I mentioned the pub.
Oh, the one that David Cameron took. François Hollande.
Yes, Hollande. And possibly Xi Jinping, actually.
No, that was by Checkers.
That was Checkers. That was the place where he left his daughter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go and see that. I'll go on a spring break there, perhaps.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. But that's enough Mitford's, Dominic. It's your birthday after all. So here's a more Sandbrook question from Peter Sarkis.
Yeah.
Excellent exposition of fascism in Britain. My question is, why didn't it take off in France? Just because they won the First World War or something deeper?
So I do think winning the First World War makes a big difference. A few people in the Discord said, you know, you're overlooking the fact that it was born in Italy. But Italy is in a different position. Italy is a recently unified country, very unstable, very uncertain, that might as well have lost the First World War because Italy has a humiliating experience in the First World War and is not rewarded with all the territory that it hoped for.
Because they have a kind of mad war, don't they? They're busy blowing the tops off mountains.
They are.
In the Alps, fighting the Austrians.
Exactly, exactly. A terrible war. Where actually the Austrians, who are not the world's greatest army, end up basically wiping the floor with them. And they fought 12 battles, I think it is, in the same place on the River Isonzo. I mean, literally, there's the 12th battle of the Isonzo where they're still trying to kind of capture these heights. Massive loss of men and money and all this sort of thing. And Italy was so disturbed in the late 1910s, early 1920s, that it's not in the same position as Britain and France. And Italy feels a tremendous sense of resentment and humiliation.
And a need to recover its virility.
Exactly.
So D'Annunzio is the classic example of that.
France is a slightly different position. France had won the First World War. France had been a fully militarized nation. It had really kind of come together to win the war. Democracy was therefore more resilient in France, but even in France. So there is actually a fascist uprising in France in 1934. In Paris, there is fighting on the streets of Paris. I think some people, quite a small number, are killed. There are far-right groups, royalist groups in France, proto-fascist groups and sort of paramilitaries and things. So French democracy is just about resilient enough. And of course, you have the Popular Front in the mid-1930s, where all the left-wing parties come together. But if France had been humiliated too in the First World War, a second successive humiliation, of course, after the Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71, you know, I think the Dreyfus case, the furore about the Dreyfus case would have been a preview of what was to come. So there's obviously a lot of anti-Semitism in France. Before the First World War, there's a tremendous feeling of humiliation and resentment. And that would have been massively, massively amplified in the early 1920s.
But also, Dominic, isn't the question, if France had been defeated, what terms would have been imposed on her?
Well, remember that France had already lost Alsace and Lorraine after the Franco-Prussian War and regained them subsequently. So that loss would have been confirmed, possibly the loss of more territory in the east, the coal mines and things, massive reparations payments. I mean, actually what happened in Weimar Germany is probably a reasonably good preview of what would have happened in France in the 1920s. So you're right about the terms, but they would have been punitive, surely.
Because I would imagine that Germany's goal would have been to permanently neuter French military capabilities.
Yeah.
So they would actually, a France that had been defeated by Germany would in the long run be more impotent than Germany proved to be, do you think?
Why would it be different from Germany though? Why would it be different from a Germany neutered by France?
Germany has larger numbers.
Yes.
I mean, it's more, you know, I mean, just the population size. And if France has lost territory and it's lost its industrial capacity,
yeah.
And who knows what other terms might have been imposed to ensure that.
I think the other thing though, Tom, actually thinking about it is that if France wanted to fight a sort of, you know, a third war, the only people to fight it with are the Germans. So it's not like the Germans who are able to pick off other little countries before moving into a world war in 1939, you know, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and so on. The French can only have a go at the Germans. They're not going to invade Switzerland or Spain.
That's true, but France probably would not be in a position to have a war against Germany without Britain.
Yeah.
And if France has been defeated in the war, then Britain has as well. So yes, again, I mean, we're into counterfactuals here.
Do you know what, Tom? We've talked about this on stage. There is a very, very complicated video game scenario called Kaiserreich. Remember I put the slide up?
I do, yeah.
It's a mod for the game Hearts of Iron. This will be meaningless to lots of our listeners anyway. But they have worked out a very complicated scenario in which there's a kind of syndicalist France or socialist Britain post 19, a defeat in 1919 or, you know, something like this. It probably actually articulates these things better than I'm doing now. I think the point is that, now I know some people, say for example, Capel Loft, who always likes to beat us up on Twitter. Some people just still insist that fascism is un-British and could never have taken off in Britain. You know, paramilitary politics, unthinkable and all this kind of thing. And that emphasizing the contingency of defeat or victory in the First World War is a red herring. I think France is a great example of a country that could easily have become an authoritarian right wing.
But Capel Loft would say that's the French.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea that Britain, where you'd had the Ulster Volunteers in 1912, you'd had similar groups in major northern cities.
No, Dominic, I think you're ignoring our bulldog love of liberty. When you're in a hole, Dominic, stop digging.
Yeah, we're clearly.
So here's another question for you.
The great sense of humour, Tom, is what would have saved us. Isn't that what people claim?
Yes. Roland S. asks, were there more links to be drawn out between the British Union and fascists and mostly and the appeasement set around Lord Halifax? Which has been much on my mind because I had a very nice time at the Clifton Literary Festival, courtesy of Simon Sebag Montefiore. He was very kindly invited me. Hmm. But of course, Clifton was, before it became notorious for the Profumo scandal, was notorious as a kind of hotbed of appeasement, wasn't it?
Yeah, this great country house in, is it Buckinghamshire, Clifton?
It's kind of what inspires The Remains of the Day.
It is.
Ishiguro novel.
I've literally just scribbled down The Remains of the Day because The Remains of the Day captures that really well. The sort of vague association between very right-wing sympathies and also the appeasement kind of circles. Maybe we could have drawn that out a bit more. That said, I think if the BUF and Mosley hadn't existed, the appeasement set would still have...
Well...
You know, they didn't need the BUF.
I mean, it's important to say, isn't it, that fascism and appeasement, there is blurring, but they are distinct.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, Chamberlain associated with it. And appeasement is a theme we should do on the... History, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. So I did an event at the Buckingham History Festival a few weeks ago, which is organized by a former friend of the show, Paul Lay, who came on to talk about Cromwell and the English Republic in the very early days of the podcast. So he organizes this festival and I did an event there with Simon Heffer, Tom, about his new book about the interwar years. And we were talking about appeasement and he has very interesting things to say about it. So he, you know, is very keen that...
They did it and they were right to do it or not.
Pretty much. Yeah. But actually, that's also the implication of Robert Harris's recent novel about Chamberlain and Munich, and which was made into a Netflix series. And of course, the thing that people forget is that the word appeasement in the 1930s did not have any of the connotations of cowardice and, you know, idiocy and folly that it now has. And appeasement to a lot of people in the 30s seemed like a sensible way of avoiding another great war and remedying what a lot of people across the political spectrum saw as the injustices or the mistakes of the post-war treaties, the Treaty of Versailles in particular. So when people said, well, look, there's a load of German speakers outside Germany who would much rather be in Germany, you know, the borders were drawn in the wrong place. There are loads of people who would have said, yeah, there's some truth in that. And actually, you know, if we maybe put these things right, Hitler will eventually either fall from power or he'll become a reasonable, you know, he's not a complete madman. You know, people made mistakes, obviously Chamberlain most famously, but I don't think they were ignoble mistakes to have made. That's what I would say about appeasement. However, you're right, we should absolutely do it.
So we should do one on that. Is there anything else that you want to discuss on fascists?
Loads.
So Harold Stassen, what role did preservation of the empire play in the British fascist movement? We didn't really talk about that, did we? Because after the war, in the 50s and 60s, isn't the Monday Club, that's a kind of high Tory group devoted to the empire?
Absolutely,
that
yes.
kind of does verge into faintly kind of fascist.
Well, there's a group called the League of Empire Loyalists, and the League of Empire Loyalists are pretty much fascistic. They're in the sort of 1950s, 1960s, and they are kind of allied to the Monday Club, loosely allied to them.
But is this an issue in the 30s?
I would say probably not massively. I'm trying to cast my mind back. Martin Pugh, in his book Hurrah for the Black Shirts, does have a chapter about the empire. But it's a bit of a dog that doesn't bark, I think. I think because maybe some people think this is controversial. I actually think most people in Britain never cared about the Empire.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it doesn't really intrude.
No.
People aren't really very interested in it.
It's amazing to me, having written about, when you think that Britain in the 1920s had the largest empire, maybe the only rival is the Empire of the Mongols in history, and then it was all lost, and it was never, ever, even remotely an election issue.
Yeah.
So the point at which it was all disappearing, people found it boring. They thought about it like most people now think about Brexit trade details.
Yeah.
Some people really care, but 8 out of 10 people, it puts them to sleep. People felt like that about the Empire.
All these kind of harumphing colonels in the gentlemen's clubs complaining about it and conspiring and plotting. I mean, they are wholly irrelevant.
Total figures of fun.
They're figures of fun, but there's no way that they're going to have support out on the streets. People just don't care.
No, you're absolutely right.
I mean, you know, if you've been, I was deputy collector in the in the Sudan, and but most people couldn't care.
They roll their eyes and laugh at them.
Yeah,
these retired colonels and people who once governed India are figures of fun in British popular culture rather than figures of admiration. Theo wants me to correct something. I described Paul Lay as a former friend of the show. He is still a very much a friend of the show. I said former friend of the show because he's a former guest on the show. I was conflating two different things there, Tom, being a guest and being a friend of the show.
Yes. Leave no room for doubt on that. Paul is very much a friend of the show. Yes.
Paul is a fan of Aston Villa, Tom.
I know he is.
He sent me a message at the weekend to congratulate me on Wolves' victory over Man City.
Did he mention Villa's 6-1 trouncing of Brighton?
He didn't.
Ollie Watkins, hat trick.
But you know, actually, this weekend, Wolves are playing Villa. I'm very anxious about it.
Very tense.
Because everybody will think, you know, Villa are clearly the favourites to win because they're in such good form. And if they do win, then you will be very smug, but utterly undeservedly because you...
I won't.
Because you don't follow football that closely.
No, I won't. All that, I'm not interested in that.
Okay.
Right. It just gives me mild pleasure to see that they're doing well, but nothing more than that.
Okay.
A bit like Surrey winning the county championship.
You said in our last podcast, didn't you? Or one of the fascism ones or something. Was there somebody from Surrey who was a...
He was the son of Rosebery.
Lord Dalmeny or whatever his name
Lord Dalmeny.
Yeah.
And Rosebery thought that he looked Jewish because his mother was a Rothschild.
Yeah. Well, he was Jewish if his mother was a Rothschild.
But Lord Dalmeny was not only an MP, but captain of Surrey. And he's the one who got permission from the Prince of Wales for Surrey to use the ostrich feathers.
Right. And you're a fan of Surrey Cricket Club.
Yeah. Surrey and Aston Villa. And the Larkin poem.
Yeah.
You know, about 1914.
Yeah.
It opens with references to the Oval and Villa Park. So it's a poem that has a particular place in my heart. Those are my two favourite grounds.
Really?
Yeah.
You prefer the Oval to Lords?
Well, I have hopes of joining the MCC.
Yeah, I knew. I was trying to trick you there.
No, the Oval is my favourite.
Right. Here's a question for you from Stephen Clark. Who are your favourite... what kind of question is this? Who are your favourite dictators, Tom, ancient and modern?
Oh, Fabius Cunctator. Fabius the Delayer, who is appointed in the wake of Lake Trasimene, which is a disastrous defeat the Romans suffer at the hands of Hannibal. And the Romans are aware that Hannibal is a mortal threat to the survival of their empire.
Right.
And in such moments of crisis, the Constitution of the Republic allows for a single man to be given complete control of the state for a 6-month period. And so they give it to Fabius, and he's called Cunctator the Delayer, because rather than engage Hannibal in battle, he just shadows him. And this proves to be the right policy, because after the 6 months, when he lays down his power and the normal constitution revives and you have the two consuls, they march off, confront Hannibal with a massive, massive army. Hannibal is hugely outnumbered, but Hannibal wipes them out at the Battle of Cannae, probably the most disastrous defeat in Roman history. So I think you'd have to go for Fabius.
I'm very keen for you, Tom, to do a series about Hannibal and Carthage.
Well, we're going to, aren't we?
Yeah. So we've got that to look forward to. You're not going to pick a favourite modern dictator. Theo doesn't want us to because he thinks we'll be cancelled.
My favourite modern dictator.
It's kind of hard, isn't it?
I don't really like any of them.
It depends how you define dictator, doesn't it? I mean, if I was choosing a sort of a strong man.
Thatcher.
I quite like Mustafa Kemal Ataturk.
Do you think he's a dictator?
Well, this is the thing. He's not really a dictator. I wouldn't say. But he's kind of...
Dictator adjacent.
Dictator adjacent.
But he's the father of his country.
He's the father of his country, exactly.
No, I don't think you can have Ataturk.
On the grounds, he's not fully dictatorial.
Well, I think you could say Mussolini's a dictator because he's consciously modelling himself on the Roman prototype. And it's people who follow up.
That's your definition.
Don't you think? I think dictator is used much too loosely.
Okay, crikey.
No, I do think dictators properly should be people who are inspired by the Roman example. So Mussolini, Hitler, Salazar, Franco.
Hold on, what about Stalin?
No. Not properly.
That's a deranged view, Tom. You're going to say that Mao and Stalin were not dictators?
Strictly speaking, no.
I would like to compile, maybe as a sort of Rest is History merch possibility, a list of Tom Holland definitions of words that offend common usage. So weird is obviously one.
Yeah.
You love to describe things as weird.
In a positive way.
Right. And your definition of a dictator, which would disallow some of the best known dictators in human history.
I think it's a word that the quality of definition has blurred.
Okay.
So it's no longer quite as valuable as it was. Anyway, Theo is nagging, so we must move on.
A quick question from Gerard S. You can answer this in one line. Gerard S. hasn't asked a question before, as far as I know, so this is an exciting moment. What are the origins of the Normans that conquered Saxon Britain?
Well, there's a clue in the name, the Northmen.
Yeah.
So basically, they're Vikings who are given what becomes Normandy by the Frankish king. But there is a story that is told about them that they're a little bit like Rome under Romulus, which is a kind of a mongrel state where Romulus opens up the asylum for people from any background to come and join this new city. There is a story that Rollo, the first Norman leader, does the same. And there's this kind of image of a great flock of birds that are of different species, implying, I think, that they're not just Normans. They are basically adventurers, a kind of startup duchy, as it becomes.
So, Tom, I wrote about Rollo in Adventures in Time, Fury of the Vikings. So his warriors called him Ganger Rolf, Rolf the Walker, but the Franks called him Rollo. And I describe how Rollo was bought off by Charles the Simple, very excellently named Frankish king. So they met in a place called Saint-Clair-sur-Epte in the autumn of 911. Rollo had to accept baptism and he had to swear allegiance to the Frankish king and promise to defend the mouth of the Seine from other raiders.
There's a story, isn't there, that after his baptism, he then went rogue and
he did
sacrificed large numbers of people to
Odin. But you know what happened after the baptism, Tom? I'll read you from Adventures in Time. As part of the ceremony, Rollo was expected to kiss the king's foot, but as a good Viking, he was having none of it. "I will never bow my knee to any man," he roared. "And no man's foot will I kiss." Eventually, he told one of his bodyguards to kiss Charles's foot for him. The warrior promptly grabbed the king's foot, jerked it upwards, and planted a huge kiss on it, causing poor Charles to fall flat on his back.
"We had good sport that day."
That's exactly what happened, Tom.
Yeah,
that's
exactly what happened.
And if you want to read more stuff like that, Adventures of the Time, Fury of the Vikings, available now in paperback.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. Oh, here's an interesting message from Xanthi Mosley, who's the daughter-in-law of Nicholas Mosley, Oswald Mosley's son. Nicholas Mosley, a very distinguished novelist, who was gripped by the podcasts. "Thank you all for your hard work producing this fascinating entertainment education. I hope the series carries on for a very, very long time."
Wow, that's nice. That's very nice. Yeah.
So Mosley's granddaughter-in-law. This is from Simon Girdleston. "As accomplished Mrs. Thatcher impersonators, who do Tom and Dominic think are the most accurate portrayals of Mrs. Thatcher by the various actresses who have played her? Meryl Streep, Janet Brown, Lindsay Duncan, Leslie Manville, Andrea Risborough, Gillian Anderson, Maureen Lipman, Sylvia Sims, or Stella Gonet?" If I tell you, Dominic, the film in which Stella Gonet plays Mrs. Thatcher, it will spoil.
Of course. You've talked about this film recently.
I have.
So my answer to that question is actually Andrea Risborough. She plays the young Margaret Thatcher in a film called The Long Walk to Finchley, and she's brilliant because she doesn't do an impersonation of Margaret Thatcher. She plays a living, breathing character. The worst, to my mind, is Gillian Anderson.
Oh, in The Crown.
I thought she was terrible. I thought that was absolutely so mannered and so just awful. Awful. What do you think, Tom? Have you seen The Crown? You like The Crown, don't you?
Yeah, I do quite like The Crown. Steve Nallon.
Yeah, Steve Nallon, very good.
He was a male, I think the only real male Mrs. Thatcher impersonator.
Apart from you.
And you, Dominic.
Yeah.
He's very, very good. So he did it through the 80s, didn't he?
For Spitting Image, for the puppet show.
Spitting Image, yeah.
Right. So just to remind you that you've got Baghdad coming, that we have the Athelstan quiz on the 9th, that we have the live stream on the 16th, and that we have the two shows, live shows for those of you in Britain, in Bath on the 23rd. And Hammersmith on the 31st. And I think, Tom, that shockingly, there are still some tickets available.
That is shocking.
Not many, but I think there are some.
I mean, presumably only up by the toilets.
One or two if they're lucky, says Theo. But still, those tickets must be, they are like gold dust, aren't they?
Literally.
Yeah. Right. We will see you all next time. Thank you so much for listening and for your support for The Rest is History, as always. And Tom, I look forward to recording the episodes on Baghdad.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Dominic. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.